Hello and welcome to the Recovering from Religion podcast. Our mission here is to offer hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. What follows is the audio from selected videos posted on Recovering from Religion's YouTube channel. So sit back, relax, and enjoy.
So without further ado, I'm just going to introduce Hayley. So the first thing, I'm just going to read you a bit of her bio, and then I will unmute her, and then we'll be able to hear her beautiful voice. So Hayley Twyman, I hope I'm pronouncing that right. She did tell me how to pronounce it before the session. I may have messed up. I am sorry. So Hayley Twyman Brack is a licensed professional counselor and freelance writer in Oklahoma. She has co-authored a textbook chapter for mental health clinicians on helping secular individuals navigate grief, and she has also written over 350 articles for a satirical sociopolitical website. In her free time, she also co-hosts a board game podcast and officiates secular and LGBTQ plus weddings. So, Hayley, welcome. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me this evening. I'm so excited to be here. It's an honor to be with you guys today.
Oh, thank you so much, Hayley. I love that you're here. I know you have done this presentation before, and I've heard so many great things about it. So I'm super, super excited for it. The only thing I'm going to ask you before you start is that a lot of people have asked about the third question of the poll. So yes. What do you mean by is belief binary? Do you mean like is belief black and white, or...
You know. So is belief a yes or no? Like, you have a belief system or you don't? Do you have faith or no? Are you a part of a religion or no? Or is it a non-binary, more of on a spectrum?
Okay, perfect. I mean, the poll is now ended, but just for you guys who were a bit confused, because I did read a couple of comments. So yeah, cool. Then Hayley, I believe you have slides, so I'm just going to let you do your thing.
So my name is Hayley Twyman Brack, and again, I'm a licensed professional counselor here in Oklahoma, so howdy, as we all say. Not really, but I feel like I have to. So our presentation today is called The Fear of Hell, Understanding the Residual Anxiety and Allowing Ourselves to Move Forward. So we've already kind of gone over my bio. Who am I? What am I doing here? How did I get in your computer screen? But let's just go over disclosure really quickly. So this presentation is for education and fun. It's not medical or mental health advice. So anything that we talk about here should be used for educational purposes, for understanding ourselves, but it's not medical advice and does not replace mental health therapy. If you do find that you need mental health care, or you're interested in finding a therapist for your own, please go to theseculartherapy.org. It is an amazing website with amazing people. And we also have findcbt.org. So that is another database of clinicians who only use evidence-based counseling. And so, of course, if you ever experience any kind of emergency or mental health or otherwise, please, please, please call 911. Go to the ER. Make sure yourself is safe and make sure that we see you again. Okay. At the end, we will have time for questions. However, we'll only be talking about general or educational questions. I can't answer any specific questions. I can't give any kind of mental health care advice. I'm only licensed in the state of Oklahoma and have a temporary license in Kansas, so I can't practice in any other states. So if personal mental health question is asked, I will refer you to consult with your own mental health therapist. But if you have questions about anxiety or maybe even grief in regards to the fear of hell, please let me know and be happy to answer those questions. So a brief outline of what we're going to be talking about. First, what the hell is hell? We're going to talk about the history of hell, how it is presented in many different religious texts, as well as how it came to become the fire and brimstone hell we all think of today. We're also going to talk about fear and anxiety, how they come, what the symptoms are. We'll discuss automatic negative thoughts, so how those thoughts come into our head and why they like to stick around even after we've deconverted. We're going to explore the fear of hell, and we're going to identify how to help ourselves and others if we are still struggling with those thoughts. All right, so let's go over a brief history of hell. So what the hell is hell? Madeline and Maya, Todd, does anybody want to talk about what they think of when they think of hell?
So two things come to my mind when I think of hell. One of them is the Christian hell with obviously fire and demons and whatnot. But then for some reason, I think it's because I like Northern culture, I also imagine it as like just ice, because in the North, in like, I think Nordic mythology, and I may be saying this wrong, so don't take my word for it, but I think that in Northern mythology, they imagine it as like just completely frozen, because obviously that is what they were more afraid of than just hell, fire. So yeah, that's how I imagine it. I'm not sure if that's normal, but yeah.
That's awesome. I didn't know. I learned something today. That's interesting. Thank you for sharing that, Amaya.
Oh, no worries. For once, I get to educate someone, even if it's maybe for a wrong fact. So I have to Google that before I just, you know, declare it to be true. But yeah.
Well, you sparked some interest there. That's awesome. Thank you. Madeline, did you have something to say as well? What are your thoughts on hell?
Yeah, well, it's fire and burning. And if you speak back to your parents, you're going there. And it's just a fear tool. I was, you know, raised lapsed Roman Catholic. So also in the Dominican Republic, where children were really not allowed to have these adult conversations. So they were just going to use it as a scare tactic, but it wouldn't be as specific as to what hell was. It was just the bad place you went to if you didn't, you know, repent or, you know, ask for forgiveness.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Just as a little note, a lot of people, well, I'm just reading the comments and people are saying things like death, everlasting punishment, eternal torture, Dante's Inferno. So do we see a pattern there?
There is quite a pattern there. We're going to talk about kind of why that is, and also why there's some differences as well. So let's talk about a brief history of hell. All right, so the afterlife in various religious texts. So in the Torah, hell is whatever your hand finds to do it with all your might. For in the realm of the dead where you are going, there is neither working nor planning nor knowledge nor wisdom. And the Bible in Revelation, it says, but the fearful and unbelieving and the abominable and murderers and whoremongers and sorcerers and idolaters and all liars shall have their part in the lake which burneth with fire and brimstone, which is the second death. The last one is the Quran. And some among them believed in it, and some among them were averse to it. And sufficient is hell as a blaze. Indeed, those who disbelieve in our verses, we will drive them into a fire. Every time their skin are roasted through, we will replace them with other skin so that may taste the punishment. Indeed, Allah ever exalted is might and wise. So hell across the board is not a fun place, is not a great place. And it sounds like in Madeline's case and in many others' cases, like it was kind of used as a fear tactic, as a scare tactic to almost teach morality. And so let's talk about why that is. So there are many interpretations of hell across different religions and often across different sects of the same religion. Like you might have someone who identifies as a Presbyterian Christian have a different belief in hell than a Methodist Christian. And that is completely normal. And while some religious teachings focus on salvation and redemptions, others appear to engage in fear mongering. For example, fire and brimstone teachings appear to have a great impact on American society. So let's talk about the history of fire and brimstone. So the fire and brimstone teachings actually impact religion in America to this day. So the Great Awakening was a response to the Age of Reason. So the Age of Reason was a time during the Industrial Revolution where we actually had an improvement in the quality of life here in the United States. And so we had better access to technology, more access to food. We had better access to medication. And so the Great Awakening, during this time, revival spread across the U.S. from the 1970s to the 1830s. And this was the first time that damnation and the fiery pits of hell ready to engulf sinners really started to take shape and really started to like flood the religious market, if you will. A quote from Jonathan Edwards is, God was an angry judge and humans were sinners. And Jonathan Edwards is one of the forefathers of this Great Awakening, as we call it. And though the Great Awakenings took place nearly two centuries ago, the tactics relying on fear of hell are still common in evangelical Christian teachings to this day, and other religions as well. Kind of like Madeline, I grew up a strict Catholic, almost became a nun, and that is a story for another day, my friends. But let's talk about fear of hell and the secular individual. We had a question in the chat, or in the poll, and it says, when somebody deconverts from a religion, does it mean that the fear of hell automatically goes away? And the results were mixed on there. And so the answer is yes and no. For some individuals, whenever they deconvert, the fear of hell does go away. Those automatic thoughts do stop. But for a lot of people, the fear of hell doesn't go away. And that's actually very common for those who have deconverted from religion to have experienced an increase or a sustained fear of hell. let's talk about what anxiety and fear are. So fear is a response to a perceived threat. It involves a sympathetic nervous system, arousal. So sympathetic nervous system, you know, whenever your palms get sweaty, your knees weak, arms are heavy, vomit on your sweat already, mom's spaghetti. Nah, I'm kidding. So that is actually the sympathetic nervous response that's happening. So whenever you experience sweaty palms, whenever you get that stomach ache, whenever your blood pressure rises, you're sweating. And so fear is really common when we're in an instance of danger. It is also very common in obsessive compulsive related disorders, as well as anxiety related disorders or fear of hell. And so anxiety is very similar to fear. So anxiety is a future-oriented state of hyperarousal. So it arises out of uncertainty and may follow fear and can consist of the same bodily arousal and automatic negative thoughts. But for the purpose of this presentation, we're going to be using fear and anxiety back and forth. Both of them are a negative emotional reaction to the idea of the fear of hell. So when it comes to anxiety and fear, it is also adaptive. There are healthy amounts of anxiety. It is our body's way of keeping us safe. If we didn't have any anxiety, we probably wouldn't survive in this world. For example, if we had no anxiety, we wouldn't wear seatbelts or study for tests in college. If we didn't have anxiety, then we wouldn't be able to fight off threats as easily. I remember my dad would tell this story whenever he was a kid. My great-grandfather was this like World War II veteran, really tough guy. And my dad, being a kid, liked to scare him. He had a lot of jump scare. He was very jumpy, responded to the jump scares really easily. And my dad said that whenever he was about 6 years old, he snuck up on my great-grandfather and while he was sleeping and just waited until he woke up. And as soon as my great-grandfather opened his eyes, he punched him in the face. Just automatically punch my dad in the face. And that was a fear response. My grandfather, of course, didn't mean to do that. That would not be okay. It felt horrible afterwards, but that was a fear response. He didn't have to say, oh, there's a six-year-old in front of me. I better pop him in the face. No, it was just like, oh, shit, there's a six-year-old in front of me. But I can't recognize that because I'm scared, and just popped him in the face. So fear also protects us. It helps us to fight back. It helps us to flee. And so let's talk about anxiety in religion. So the research is mixed in regards to if being religious is associated with higher rates of anxiety. For example, the research suggests that identifying with a religion may decrease death-related anxiety. However, high religiosity is correlated with higher rates of obsessive-compulsive disorder, which is an anxiety-related disorder. And so scrupulosity appears to affect both the religious and those who have deconverted. So we'll talk a little bit about what that means. So scrupulosity is a common type of obsession in OCD and other anxiety-related disorders. Most experiencing scrupulosity are religious. However, approximately 20% of those who experience scrupulosity do not identify with a religion. So these thoughts, what these are, they are thought patterns, they are obsessions, they are automatic thought processes that we have that revolve around fear of going to hell, fear of being a bad person, fear of sin. And so what's crazy is, like this says, 20% of those who experience these thoughts are not religious at all. And these are often experienced through what are called automatic negative thoughts. So let's talk about automatic thoughts. So Maya or Madeline, you want to guess how many thoughts you think we have per day?
Millions. Yeah. I'm not going to even try to embarrass myself on the internet. I'm just going to say millions and leave it like that.
I was going to say thousands to be a little safer.
But kind of in the middle there, it's 40 to 60,000 thoughts per day is what research suggests that we experience, which is a lot. And so just because they have 40 to 60,000 thoughts per day doesn't mean that they're all the same. So these thoughts, we have thousands of thoughts per day, and many come automatically and without effort. Let's say, for example, if I'm walking through the house at night and I stub my toe on a cat toy, I don't have to stop and say, I stubbed my toe. This hurts. Insert slew of bad words. I don't have to like stop and think about my toe hurts. I need the cuss right now. Like, no, automatically I stub my toe. I think out and I say, son of a bitch, I stubbed my toe. You curse at yourself. Like, it's automatic. Side note, research suggests that if you do cuss when you are in pain, your pain receptors decrease. They actually inflicted pain on people in an ethical way, I promise, as much as research can be. But, and they had them either like say a slew of cuss words or say like random words like cup or dish or say nothing at all. And those who cussed, their pain receptors literally decreased. So cussing is good for you, the research suggests. Anyway, automatic negative thoughts often come without effort, and they're not always based on truth either. Just because we have a thought, it doesn't mean that it's true. I like to distinguish this for clients as well. Feelings are always valid, but thoughts are not always true. So for example, if I have a five-year-old who comes to my office and says that they're afraid of the monster under their bed, now I'm not going to say, don't be scared, because that's not going to work, right? You want to validate that anxiety. I want to validate the five-year-old's anxiety. Say, it's okay to be scared. But just because we validate that anxiety and it's okay to feel scared, it doesn't mean that there's a monster under the bed. So just because we have a thought, it doesn't mean that it's true, though the feelings that follow are always valid. So when it comes to anxiety, anxiety can often lead to anxious thoughts. And so the thing is, anxious thoughts often lead to anxiety. And so anxiety can also lead to more anxious thoughts. And anxious thoughts can lead to more anxiety. We call this the cycle of anxiety, or as I call it in my office, the cycle of shit. Whenever the more anxious you get, the more negative thoughts you have, the more negative thoughts you have, the more anxious you have. And the kicker is, whenever we have thoughts to make us anxious, such as the fear of hell, or the fear of being a bad person, or the fear of leaving a religion, what happens is the more that we try to push these thoughts away, the stronger they come. And so we're going to talk a little bit more about that in a moment here. So let's talk about belief. So let's talk about how belief is maintained. So we've all heard of classical conditioning, or a lot of us have, which is Pavlov's theory that if we pair a neutral stimulus with a rewarding stimulus, that eventually that neutral stimulus will elicit the reaction of the rewarding stimulus. So for example, Pavlov paired a dog's food with a bell. And so after a while, whenever he would ring the bell, the dogs would salivate just like they did with the food. Operant conditioning is a little bit different. So operant conditioning is from B.F. Skinner. And basically it says that behaviors are created or maintained based on consequences. So let's think about casinos for a minute. So I'm sure a lot of us have gambled or know what a casino is. In rural Western Oklahoma, my dad, after church on my 18th birthday, took me to my first casino. So had lots of experience there. With casinos, like you put money in a machine and you're not always rewarded for it. But when you are, like that's what keeps us going to the machine. So operant conditioning is we believe that our behaviors are eliciting a reaction. We put money in a pop machine, we push a button, we get a pop. We're reinforced that way. So troll dolls, back in the 90s, I remember as a kid, troll dolls are really popular and thought of as good luck charms at the casinos or at the bingo halls. You see these older ladies with tons of troll dolls, like all stacked around their bingo cards, because they thought they would bring good luck. That's operant conditioning at work. I've won whenever the troll dolls are there. Therefore, the troll dolls hold all the magical power. So we tend to, when it comes to operant conditioning, associate.
Haley, sorry, yes. Just a little note. I just got a message of someone asking to repeat a sentence that I don't remember you saying, but hopefully you will remember. Just because we have a thought doesn't mean it's true, but ...
Oh, but
I think someone missed the last bit.
Yes, the feeling is always valid. Your feelings are always valid, even though the thoughts might not be true.
Okay.
If we have a five-year-old who's afraid of the monster under the bed, I'm not just going to say, don't be anxious, because that's not okay. Or validate the anxiety, but it doesn't mean that there's a monster under the bed. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. And so when it comes to operant conditioning, we tend to associate rewards with positive results, even if we're not rewarded each time. And this develops into ritualistic behaviors and thoughts, and this occurs in humans and animals. So one example I found online of this is, I guess, Michael Jordan, whenever he was playing for the Bulls, especially that, was it 1997? I'm not a sports person, but in 97, over the Chicago Bulls were the hit, then he would wear his University of North Carolina shorts under his Chicago Bulls uniform because he believed that it would make him win. And so that's an example of operant conditioning and how it can lead to ritualistic behaviors, and it's no different in religion. So again, classical conditioning is associating an involuntary response to a stimulus. Operant conditioning associate a voluntary behavior to a consequence. So operant conditioning, I believe that my behavior is leading to this response. I believe that me wearing my University of North Carolina shorts under my Bulls uniform is going to lead me to win. I believe that surrounding my bingo card with these troll dolls is going to give me a big payout. So let's talk about how this is maintained. So how belief is maintained. So operant conditioning of this sort, when it comes to faith, is reinforced on what's called a variable reinforcement schedule, which is difficult to extinguish. So for example, if I, this is different from like a fixed reinforcement. So if every time we do something, we're rewarded for it, that's called a fixed reinforcement schedule. So every time I work 2 weeks, I get paid. Every time I work 2 weeks, I get paid. So for example, I go 4 weeks without getting paid. I'm probably not going to stay at that job very long, right? I would hope not. But for example, if we are going from a variable reinforcement schedule, that means we never really know when we're going to be rewarded. So we're going to keep, you know, when it comes to, let's say, gambling, we're going to keep hitting that slot machine, hitting that slot machine, hitting that slot machine, because we know eventually there will be a payout. We don't know when, but we've been reinforced before. So we're going to keep pulling that handle until we get that payout. So even if I rationally know that, you know, I'm just putting in, you know, $20, $40, $60 into this machine, even though I know it's wasting money, I may keep playing for the payout, because after a while, like, I've already sunk $120 in, I might as well keep going. And so think about this in regards to prayers and religion. Like, is every prayer answered? No, it's not. But those reinforce us to keep praying. Those reinforce us to keep going through those religious rituals. And so if we have, like, if it's we're automatically praying situations, or if we do these, I remember the novenas in the Catholic Church, where you pray the Hail Mary 9 times. Like, you're supposed to do that if you wanted something to happen. No, it doesn't always happen. Whenever it does, there's that payout. So that's what keeps us in that ritual. It's also harder to break. Now, like I said, if I go 4 weeks without getting paid, I'm going to lose my job. I'm going to quit my job. But if I go, if I pray 90 times and I don't get my prayer answered until the 91st time, then I say, oh, I just have to pray 91 times in order for my prayer to be answered in that way.
You know, this reminds me of a theory I learned in psychology of, like, parenting style. So is this idea that when parents kind of alternate giving attention and ignoring the child when the child expresses a need, that is when people develop a sense of neediness. So they're constantly asking for attention because they don't know when they're going to get that attention and when they're not. Whilst for parents that never paid attention to their children, the children kind of learn that behavior and they just stop trying to interact with them. I feel like it's all connected for some reason. It really reminded me of it.
You know what it's like to journey out of a once cherished belief. Maybe you were devoutly religious, escaped a cult, or perhaps you simply navigated out of some very difficult days, and now you'd like to help someone else do the same. Recovering from Religion is a wonderful support organization for people who feel confused, troubled, and alone as they come to grips with the possibility that they no longer hold a religious belief, or that they risk losing everything if they're honest with themselves and others about their journeys. These people need our help, and Recovering from Religion needs yours. RFR is seeking volunteers. Perhaps you're formerly religious, or you have a specific skill set like speaking a foreign language. Maybe you're just a good listening ear. The RFR Volunteer Training Program will help you translate those abilities into critical assistance, encouragement, and support for the men, women, and youth who contact RFR every day from all over the world. You can relate. You can understand. And you can make their journeys easier. Join the team at Recovering from Religion and remind someone else that they are not alone and someone is here to help. To find out more, click the volunteer tab at recoveringfromreligion.org.
Absolutely, you're exactly right. So that's the first one would be like the anxious.
Exactly.
Yeah. What is it?
Ambivalent.
Maybe yes, translating. There we go. Yeah. Yes, you got it right. gold star in therapy. That you've taught me two things today, so you get a gold star. I appreciate it. But yeah, that's exactly right. It's exactly the same concept there. And so let's see here. So let's tie this together. So participating in religion may operantly condition us to expect a consequence based on participating in rituals. Thus, it may be very difficult to completely shake a religious belief or an expectation, especially if one is supposed to prevent us from going to hell. So for example, atheists praying when we're in danger. Like if we are automatically conditioned to, you know, pray whenever we're in sticky situations, like if that has been our go-to for so long, it's a behavior that's been learned, it's kind of automatic. It's kind of like driving a car. We don't always have to think about it. It just kind of comes naturally. So go ahead, I'm sorry.
If you don't mind, that brings to mind, there's a lot of expressions like in Spanish that we use, like, God forbid, like if you ever say anything like, you know, if they go skydiving, it may malfunction and they may die. And then they're like, oh my God, God forbid. And you're supposed to do all these things just because your word could almost like jinx it. So yeah, there's a lot of ritual in that also that stems from it, I would think.
Absolutely. That's the perfect example as well. And it's just kind of like an automatic thing, right? I mean, I hate to simplify it that way, but when we put like money in the pop machine, we don't have to think like, oh, I hope that my pop will come out. Like we're conditioned that our pop will come out. We're conditioned that if we say, God forbid, it's going to, you know, unjinx us in a way. So that's a great example. Thank you, Madeline. All right. And so, so if we have this fear of hell, despite being non-religious, we might try not to think about it. So if we have these negative thoughts pop on our head, we might say that, oh, no, I shouldn't be thinking of these. But again, this can only increase the anxiety and intrusiveness of the thought, because the more that we try to push a thought away, the stronger that it gets. So secular individuals may have an automatic thought about hell, which is completely normal for an individual going through the deconversion process and breaking what they have been operantly conditioned to believe and engage in. And again, the more that we suppress it, the worse it gets, which may increase our distress, because atheists and secular individuals shouldn't fear hell, right? Like, we're not supposed to fear hell. We are secular. We're atheists. It should all go away. And for some, it does, and that's awesome. But for many of us, it doesn't.
And there's always, too, sometimes a remnant just in case, you know, mm-hmm. It's like, well, what's the words? What are the words going to hurt? Just in case, you know, like to cover your bases. But it's that indoctrination, like you don't realize how deep it is.
Absolutely. I've met many people who have been gone from religion or left their church, you know, 10, 15 years ago, and they still experience that those thoughts. They just come automatically, especially when you have 40 to 60,000 per day. It's hard to keep track of that damn many of them sometimes. But yeah, they often come in thought patterns, and we'll kind of talk about why that is. So now that we know that the more often we try to avoid religious thoughts, the more our brains produce them, what can we do? Because we can do something. So what are thoughts? So automatic thoughts are not always rational, like fear of hell, but also social anxiety thoughts. So I think back to being in the seventh grade. Seventh grade Haley was not a cool dude. She wore wind pants and SpongeBob shirts like 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. She was a really strange duck. But she also had a lot of social anxiety. She would often think that, for example, people didn't like her. And so because I thought people didn't like me, I didn't talk to people. Because I didn't talk to people, I didn't make friends. Because I didn't make friends, I didn't think people liked me. So on and so forth. And so those thoughts, just because we have them and they create anxiety, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're true. So automatic negative thoughts are not always purposeful. Again, if I stub my toe, do I have to consciously tell myself I'm in pain? Do I have to consciously say, oh, I should say son of a bitch right now to feel better? No, we just automatically do so. And automatic negative thoughts are often emotion-based. So happy emotions often produce happy thoughts, whereas anxious emotions often make anxious thoughts. Again, thoughts are difficult to avoid. So right now, I would like you to not think about a purple cow drinking orange juice. Don't do it.
You know, I was really wondering, because the first thing I saw was the cow, and I was thinking, what the hell does that have to do with this topic, like the presentation, but... Got it. I got the point.
The method to the madness. We're talking about World War II veterans and purple cows today. You just thought there was a presentation on hell.
I'm being pleasantly surprised.
So, like I said, don't think about that purple cow drinking orange juice. Madeline, I see you thinking about that purple cow drinking orange juice. I told you not to. Can't help it, right? So the more that we try to push a thought away or try not to think about it, then we start thinking about not thinking about it. And then the stronger it gets, the more anxious we get. And so what we do instead is challenge and replace those thoughts. So I'm going to give some examples of different things that we can do to decrease the intensity of these thoughts, as well as hopefully make them go away in certain circumstances. So the first thing we can do is what's called thought challenging. So first we do is we identify the thought leading to fear. For example, what if hell is real and I'm wrong? I've heard that said many a times by clients. You know, as part of a secular therapy project, I've worked a lot with clients who are going through the deconversion process. And that's a really common thing. What if I'm wrong and I go to hell? What if I'm wrong and hell is real? What if I'm wrong and I'm a horrible person? And so, of course, those thoughts are going to lead to things like anxiety, fear, might lead to anger, might lead to confusion. And so when we have those thoughts, like we said, just because we have a thought doesn't mean that it's true. Just because a kid says that there's a monster under the bed doesn't mean that it's true. So what we want to do is examine the thought for truth. what is the likelihood that this thought is true? What is the evidence that there is a fear of hell? I mean, it's been in religious textbooks, but across those religious textbooks, they're all different. I've never met anyone who's gone to hell and come back. Never met a man I didn't like, so I don't think they've been to hell and back. So we want to examine the truth for it. Like, do I have evidence to suggest this thought is real? And we also want to identify the most realistic outcome. So if, for example, when we have this thought, you know, if hell is real, am I really going to hell, or am I just an anxious person? Like, even if hell is real, which it's not, like, we're probably a good people. Like, all of you guys are good people, I think. And so, but the thing is, like, we have to examine, you know, is this thought true? And, you know, once we look at the evidence for that, hopefully our anxiety will go down. So that's one way that we can start to decrease those thoughts, is looking at the evidence for them. Do I have evidence that there is a hell? Yes or no? Probably not. I don't have any evidence. If you do, let me know. But hopefully your anxiety will go down after that. And so something else that we can do is what's called exposure therapy. So it sounds counterintuitive, but with exposure, not exposure therapy, just exposure. So like I said, avoidance can lead to intrusiveness. So the more a thought is avoided, the more intrusive and anxiety inducing it may become. So exposure may actually reduce intrusiveness. So exposure involves purposely exposing yourself to the source of anxiety until it's no longer anxiety provoking. So for example, if I'm afraid of roller coasters, I was terrified of roller coasters, but I ride one of those bad boys every day to work, eventually I'm going to stop being afraid of roller coasters. It'd be really awesome to ride one every day to work, I'm just saying. But, or if I'm afraid of diving boards and I'm terrified the first time I jump off a diving board, after my 50th or 60th time, I'm not going to be afraid anymore. I'm going to have exposed myself to it. And so it's the same thing with our thoughts. You know, if we have an anxiety provoking thought and we try to push away and that anxiety grows, well, the more that we expose ourselves to this thought by thinking about it over and over again, or by writing it out over and over again, the less power that is going to have over us because we are exposed to it. I saw something neat the other day. It is a new kind of exposure therapy where you put the thought in Microsoft Word. So like, I'm going to hell, or I'm a bad person. And you just like jack with the font and the colors. Like, you put it in Comic Sans, you make it like baby pink, baby blue, and you make it size 96 font all the way to 11 font. You just mess with it. And what that does is, you know, you're seeing that thought on paper, you're making it look ridiculous in Comic Sans or Wingdings 2 or whatever tickles your fancy. And it just takes the power away from the thought. It's no longer this like burden in our brain. It's these silly words on paper. So that can also be something that can take some of the power away from those thoughts, because when we're suffering from those thoughts for so long, then what that does is that it just increases our anxiety. It gives more power to the thought. And so that just takes that power away. So those are a couple of ways of looking for the evidence and exposing ourselves to them that can hopefully help to decrease or challenge these thoughts.
So what if it leads to too much, like overwhelm or anxiety, if you were to do some exposure or anything like that? Do you recommend, like, I know that you can't recommend anything, but when you speak to this, is this like a mental practice for people to practice individually?
Yeah, so it can be things that we practice individually, but if our distress or anxiety is too severe, I always recommend getting a therapist. Now, I know I'm biased because it's my job, but I have one of my own and we're pretty cool. And so if we feel like our anxiety is too much, or we can't handle it on our own, or if it's just overwhelming or gone on so long, then definitely reach out to a therapist. Like I said, Secular Therapy Project has awesome therapists like me and a lot of my friends too. But yeah, if this becomes too severe, like I said, reach out to a therapist. And again, you know, these are just some ideas for education. You know, you don't have to take this as medical advice. Please don't take it as medical advice. I'm not a doctor, nor do I play one on TV. But these are just some things that we can explore for ourselves.
Cool. Thank you.
Well, of course. And so something else that we can also do is positive self-talk. So we can reassure ourselves, this fear is normal and natural, but it will pass. So the research suggests that an emotion like anxiety or fear or stress, with one trigger, that emotion only lasts about 10 to 15 minutes. What often happens is whenever we get into those negative thought processes, or we keep exposing ourselves to a trigger, then what happens is like our anxiety goes up and it keeps re-triggering and re-triggering and re-triggering. And so if we notice we're in that thought pattern, we're feeling really anxious, and we can do something to distract ourselves, get our mind off of the thought or whatever to decrease the power, then that anxiety will pass eventually. I mean, sometimes anxiety feels like it lasts forever, and sometimes panic attacks can last for up to an hour, but anxiety doesn't last forever, as evidenced by right now. No, maybe I'm a little anxious right now because I'm doing a presentation, but that's beside the point.
I wasn't aware that panic attacks could last an hour. I thought it was just like 20 minutes, but an hour is a long time to have a panic attack. I can't imagine if anyone has been suffering, like in the audience has been suffering for an hour. I am so sorry. I can't imagine how horrible that is.
And even severe or even low-grade anxiety that's persistent can just last for prolonged periods. And a lot of people experience it physically differently, as far as I know.
Right. It's very true. Like anxiety, we see a lot in kids and in myself, oddly too. I'm a very somatic anxiety person. Whenever I get anxious, I get sweaty palms, I get an upset stomach, just like little kids do. And for others, it's a lot of worrying, or it might be come out as agitation or aggression. And we often talk about anger as a secondary emotion, which typically means there's a primary emotion underneath it, whether that be stress, whether that be anxiety, whether that be hungry. That can lead to anger as well. And so anxiety can manifest in people in many different ways. And oftentimes when someone comes in for one problem, we often see it's like for anger, we often see it's anxiety or something else underneath it. So what we can do is, like I said, we can reassure ourselves that this will pass. We're feeling anxious now. It's not going to last forever. I can put on an episode of The Office and veg out for a little bit. We can also give ourselves grace. It takes time to overcome this fear. It's not just a switch. Very rarely are deconversion processes just a flip of the switch. I believe one day and I don't. It's often a process. And so along with that, a lot of those fears and a lot of those thoughts, it'll take some time to subside. And that's completely normal and natural. You can identify as an atheist and have these thoughts for years. It doesn't make you any less of an atheist or an agnostic. And we can also recognize how far we've come. For example, if we used to be very distressed whenever we drove by a church, we can think about, remember how distressed you were a year ago when you left the church? Remember how you thought that your world wasn't going to get any better? Remember how anxious you were or how sad you were? Look how far you've come. Look how much of a support network you've built since then. You found some awesome people through the Secular Therapy Project and recovering from religion. Like, think about how far you've come in your journey as well, because it's really easy for us to look at where we haven't gone. And I always talk about anytime there's uncertainty or looking towards the future, anxiety likes to fill in the gaps. Anxiety is a fortune teller, but it's a really shitty fortune teller because it just wants to tell you about what the worst case scenario will be. And very often, most of the time, that doesn't happen. And so when we look back, we want to look back at how far we've come. We want to look back of how much progress we've made, because that can be motivating and also decreasing that anxiety. And also, we can give ourselves a compliment. You don't need hell to scare you into being a good person. You are a good person, by George. And so don't be afraid to give yourself some positive self-talk. Really reassure yourself, because it's really important that we are our own best friends. There's one person that we're around 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for our entire life, and that's ourselves. And so it's very Mr. Rogers of me, but we need to love ourselves and give ourselves some positive self-talk there, because we're going through a hard journey. And so don't forget, be afraid to give yourself a compliment.
Oh. I love that. Very relevant side note, but I love that.
Oh, I'm glad. I feel like we need to be our own advocate sometimes.
Definitely. I feel like it's so easy to put ourselves down and to feel like, we're not doing enough, but we are. Like, I'm just thinking these last couple of weeks, how stressful they have been with the election and COVID and everything. And we're all here. We're all, enjoying this presentation, and I think we're all doing so much better than we could hope, because I feel like it's been such a crazy year. So don't feel bad about yourselves, guys. I know that it's a very obviously, if you can't feel bad, that's a silly sentence, but you know what I mean. A bit of prep talk, it's always a good idea, and you guys are amazing. So thank you all for being here, and I feel like I'm rambling now because I lost my train of thought, but I think I got the message across, hopefully.
You did.
Thank you so much for sharing. This is important. This has been a really hard year, guys. This has been a really shit year. And it's okay. We can say that it's a shit year. We can say that things are hard, and we can acknowledge that we're having troubles and struggles, but also give ourselves a pat on the back that we have made it so far. We have made it to November in 2020. We had wildfires this year. Kobe Bryant passed away. We had a pandemic. Oklahoma just had an ice storm. We had the election. There's a lot of shit that happened in 2020, man, and you all made it and you're here. So we can acknowledge that it's been a hard year and still applaud ourselves for making it through. So good job, and thank you, Amaya.
Thank you so much. I feel like when you listed it, it sounds so post-apocalyptic. But as you said, we're here, so that's great.
What did you say? I'm so sorry. I didn't hear what you said.
Oh, sorry. So my English accent is absolutely awful. So I was just saying that when you were listing all the things that have happened this year, it sounds so like apocalyptic. It sounds like the end of the world is coming, but we're all still here. So yeah, thank you for saying that.
And we are doing more than surviving. We are thriving, my friends.
Exactly.
And so, you know, like we were talking about with Madeline here, you know, if we believe that our anxiety is too much, or if these thoughts go into suicidal thoughts or self-harm thoughts or actions, or if we just want someone to talk to and process with, you know, don't be afraid to reach out to a therapist. You know, again, call 911 if it's an emergency, but reach out to the Secular Therapy Project. Connect with an awesome secular therapist across the country. We now have a lot of clinicians have switched to telehealth. I was not a telehealth provider until March 15th, 2020, and I became a telehealth provider overnight. We've all learned how to do it. And so there's a lot more access now as well. Had a lot of rural Oklahomans reach out to me since then, which is amazing. You can also, again, reach out to findcbt.org. Keywords to look for are secular, atheist friendly. Both of those are options on Psychology Today. Also look for evidence-based practitioners. So things like cognitive behavioral therapy, acceptance and commitment therapy, motivational interviewing, things like that are good buzzwords or keywords, but especially look for evidence-based counseling, because that way you know that you're going to get a clinician who is using research-backed methods in order to help treat you. So how do we support others? Let's talk about how we support our fellow men and women and others. So supporting others, even if you aren't experiencing a fear of hell, others may. So things we want to keep in mind is our experience is not the same as others. Different religions, cultures, and life experiences may affect how strongly the fear of hell exists. So we need to recognize that some may be culturally religious and without a belief system. So let's kind of break this down a little bit. So different religions, cultures, and life experiences may affect how strongly fear of hell is. So for example, if you were raised, I can't remember the term that Madeline used, but growing up we heard cradle Catholic, where, you know, you were baptized and you're just kind of like, you weren't Catholic anymore. That person might not have a strong fear of a hell as somebody who, you know, went through the whole process, was confirmed at age 18, was in it the whole time. But they might have the same. You know, just because we go through a same religion, it doesn't mean we're going to have the same fear of hell either. It all depends on how you're raised. It depends on your biological makeup. It depends on your life circumstances, your own trauma. And so it may be completely different. Madeline, did you have something to say? I'm so sorry.
No, I was just going to say, I used the expression lapsed Catholic. You know, I'm an only child and my parents thankfully are very forward thinking. And, you know, as kids, they sent the kids to church for the just in case part of it. And eventually we just ended up moving to the United States from the Dominican Republic. And then all of the facade just fell away when we didn't have to keep up appearances for the family. But yeah, I was baptized and I did my, I didn't do the confirmation. Yeah, the confirmation where they, you have to go and confess. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I'm not going to derail the conversation any further. Please go on.
No, that was wonderful. I appreciate you sharing. And lapsed Catholic, I couldn't think of the term that you said. Thank you so much. And thank you for sharing your experience as well. I appreciate that. So, you know, we recognize that even though somebody was born or raised in the same religion, they may have different fears of hell. And we might also recognize that people might be culturally religious without having the belief system. For example, somebody might be secularly Buddhist, like practice the Buddhist philosophy, but not necessarily abide by their religion. You know, some might keep up some of the traditions or some of the rituals from their old faith because it's comforting or because it was important to someone in their family, but they might not have that belief system. It does not make them any more or less of an atheist. We're just very different. And so many of us here are different on the Dawkins scale. So let's look at the Dawkins scale. So the Dawkins scale is kind of like a scale of belief. So it goes from strong theist to strong atheist. So a strong theist, I do not question the existence of God. I know he exists. Why does it have to be he? Come on. De facto theist, I cannot know for certain, but I strongly believe in God and live life on the assumption that he is there. A weak theist is I'm very uncertain, but I'm inclined to believe in God. Pure agnostic is God's existence and non-existence are exactly, equal probable. It's been a while since I said that. A weak atheist, I do not know whether God exists, but I'm inclined to be skeptical. A de facto atheist, I cannot know for certain, but I think God is very improbable, and I live my life under the assumption that he is not there. And then a strong atheist is I am 100% sure that there is no God. And so this is a whole spectrum of belief. You know, you might be a strong theist and you might deconvert to a pure agnostic, or you might be a de facto atheist and eventually become a strong atheist. Deconversion is the act of leaving a religion because of changing personal beliefs. It may be gradual, it may be rapid, and we may move up and down the Dawkins scale as we go. So we might start out as a strong theist, and we might move to a weak agnostic, and then we might move to a strong atheist, and we might move back to a strong theist, so on and so forth. The deconversion process is not a linear thing. We might go back and forth in our belief system. And again, you know, if we left the church 2 years ago, and during that time, we have shifted back and forth in our beliefs, it doesn't mean that we're failing as an atheist. It doesn't mean that we're, you know, lapsing in our thinking skills or whatever. It just means that we're going through a normal process called deconversion. And so you or a friend can still identify as an atheist while experiencing the fear of hell developed from identifying with the old religion. You know, if we do have those automatic thoughts about hell, it also doesn't mean that we're sliding back on the Dawkins scale either. But so it's completely valid to be an atheist and be sliding on the Dawkins scale. It's completely valid to be an atheist and have these negative thoughts. It does not decrease your ability to identify as an atheist. So let's talk about supporting others. So even if we are not having the same experience as others, we can still support them. We can empathize, destigmatize, and advise. See what I did there? I was really proud of that. Like, that took me like a whole day to kind of think about what that last one will be.
The musicality is beautiful.
Thank you. I appreciate that. So when we empathize, we listen to their struggle and try to understand how they're feeling. Do they need sympathy or solution in times like this? This is something I give with my couples a lot that I work with. For having an argument, like someone will say, they're not listening. Well, I'm just trying to help. All right. Does your partner need sympathy or solution right now? They need you to like problem solve for them, or just like listen to them rant. And so whenever your friend is experiencing this fear of hell, you know, do they need sympathy or solution? Do they need us to kind of help them process? Do they need us to help them find a therapist? Do they need us to just listen? We can also destigmatize, share with them your own experience of deconversion and fear of hell. Or if you've never experienced it, refer to this presentation or other stories you've heard. Make sure that you know what you're going through isn't rare, it isn't strange. And then last, we can advise. We can give referrals to supportive mental health care professionals. You know, we can refer them to the ER if we need to, but that's how we can help others going through this process. So in conclusion, the fear of hell is not uncommon among non-religious individuals. Avoiding or shaming ourselves for the fear of hell could only make the thoughts and fears stronger. We can actively challenge our belief of hell, give ourselves grace during the deconversion process, and seek mental health counseling. And we can support friends through empathizing, destigmatizing, and advising them to seek professional mental health treatment. All right, that's what I have. Any questions?
Amazing. There is quite a few, so that is perfect. Thank you so much. And sorry, I just received like 3 questions in personal messages suddenly. So yeah, we definitely have quite a few of them. But thank you so much, Hayley. That was so, so good. As I said before, it's just a topic that so many people struggle with, so many religious people struggle with. And I love how you said that you're not any less of an atheist just because you struggle with it, because it's just so absolutely normal that if you have been told all your life that, you know, hell is coming for you if you stop being religious, then obviously you're going to have that fear. Like, that is so natural. So thank you so much for destigmatizing it and for giving such a like lucid presentation with scientific evidence and, you know, all the facts that we all needed and all the support and all the encouragement. So it was amazing. Thank you so, so much.
Well, yeah, thank you. It was great. And I learned about cultural religious people. So that fits along with the lapsed religious or Catholic for me too. So that was great. Lots of information. But yeah, Amaya, if you want, we can jump into the questions that we have.
So, well, okay. So first I'm just going to ask like a basic question, which is, do you know what percentage of ex-religious people suffer from fear of hell? Is that like a study that maybe has been done about it that you're aware of?
No, not that I'm aware of. I know that it's very, very common. And a lot of people I've worked with the deconversion process is very common. And of course, I have had a lot of individuals who say, no, I actually, you know, the fear of hell went away way before I, you know, left my religion. And that's common too. So I'm not sure of any statistics, but that's a good question. I'm going to write that down and research for myself. I appreciate you.
Someone is asking if you feel like you can maybe not you personally, but like it can be compared the fear of hell with the fear of the Armageddon or concentration camps or torture or, you know, that kind of extremely suffering inducing scenarios that could happen. Do you feel like they're compatible?
Yeah.
I don't know what the word is, but hopefully you know what I mean.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. So the, such like the fear of Armageddon, the fear of end of times, growing up. So I had like a very Catholic grandma and I had a very Protestant grandma. So I got the best of both worlds there. And the Protestant grandma, like we had, what was called like a hell house. Have you guys heard of the hell houses where you go on Halloween and instead of a haunted house, it's all the like seven circles of hell. If you like sin, if you have sex before marriage, you're like going to be caught on fire. Or if you have an abortion, then you're going to be like, I don't know, Rolling Stones or shit for 450 years. It's like, they're meant to scare you. And so a lot of times these like fears of Armageddon or fears of end of time, they're very similar to the fear of hell. They can be related to it. They can come from the same religion or they can be completely different. But we have seen that as well. I was actually, when I posted about this on my Twitter page, whenever you guys had made the announcement or whatnot last week, I had a friend from back in high school I hadn't spoken to in like 15 years reach out and say that she experienced a fear of Armageddon like for years after she left our small town. So it's very common, and it's maintained in the same way. You know, if you are raised to believe that this is the end of times, and if you don't do what you're supposed to do, David Cameron is going to be stuck on the earth with you after God has taken all the good people, then of course you're going to have that. No one wants to be stuck with David Cameron.
Yeah, definitely. And there has been, sorry, just a follow-up question to that, which is, I think you kind of answered it, but I'm just going to ask anyway. Do you feel like the idea of annihilation, again, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right, but, you know, more like the idea of the end of the world rather than hell has been maybe more popular lately than maybe before? Or do you feel like it has always been there?
No, so like the annihilation, like the kind of revelation kind of thing. I really feel like it became popular with the Left Behind series in the 80s. Just from my understanding, like I haven't done a whole lot of research into this, but through the late 80s to the mid 90s, whenever the Left Behind series came out, followed by, again, the David Cameron movie, where you really saw in film, like people being taken up by God. And then there's these people who are left on earth and they have to sever for 7 years. I believe that really made it a tangible idea for people. I feel like that fear really came. Because I remember, like I said, my grandma's Pentecostal church, like we all gathered together and watched that on movie nights. The youth group did watch the Left Behind series. And so, yeah, I feel like that is something that's very common as well.
Well, thank you. We have a question here about how can we better understand people that are still afraid of hell?
And so I think the same thing advice. We need to empathize and destigmatize. Like that's common as well. And so if somebody is still religious, you know, like I said, religion is kind of a double-edged sword. In some instances, it is helpful for people. In some instances, very hurtful for people. No, I'm not religious myself, but I have clients who come into my office who are religious. And if religion is helpful for them, then it is helpful for them. And so I think we just need to, as human beings, empathize with them. No, we might not fully understand where they're coming from or why they have that belief system, but it's important for us to listen and try to understand. We don't have to agree, but at least understand where they're coming from to not widen that divide.
Okay, and I'll add a follow-up here about a person, and you've touched on this already, a person that presented themselves as a non-believer but was still struggling with the fear of hell. We've been talking about that. They're asking here, it would be nice to better understand how it can actually be possible.
So how can it be possible
for a non-believer to still have that fear?
Ah, yeah. And so it's very common, like I said in the presentation, 20% of those who suffer from scrupulosity are non-religious. And so a lot of times when we're working with things, let's say like OCD, we might have different fears that have no basis in truth. Like logically, we know that they don't make sense, but we still have these fear. We have these automatic intrusive thoughts. So if you look at things like the Y box, which is a common assessment measure for OCD, you see everything on there from, you know, fear of germs, to fear of contamination, fear of being poisoned. Like, who is being poisoned? We're not like on King Arthur's court in the 1400s. Like, it's very rare that somebody's going to actually poison us, but people, we actually, these thoughts are common, and the anxiety is valid. And so in the same way, like if we have never been, grown up as being religious, we might still have these thoughts as well. Sometimes our brain just produces these thoughts and we latch onto them. It's completely normal. It's in, not to downplay, you know, the fear of being poisoned, because that's normal as well. I mean, it's something that we, as you might want to work through with the clinician, but the anxiety that comes from it is valid.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah.
Makes sense. Yeah. I was going to ask, because I get sometimes really, really scared of someone like kidnapping me when I leave the house, or like killing me or something. And that has never happened. So it's not like I have a, you know, a condition happening before in my life, but I still get that fear every now and then. And it's just really, really frustrating. So yeah, thank you for saying that, because I feel like it can be applied to a lot of different situations. So yeah, thank you.
Yeah, of course. And I say this a lot because my brain's the same way. Brains are weird. And brains just kind of like come up with shit sometimes too. And you know, whether or not we have evidence to support it, my brain's the same way. Like I also have a fear of being kidnapped. And so like when I go for my runs, I like play scenarios in my head, like what am I going to do to fight off an attacker? I've never been attacked.
Oh my God, same. Happens exactly the same, yeah.
I can use my keys between my fists, and I will use my like three lessons of jujitsu to, I will kick some ass. This never happened, but the fear is still there.
Yeah, definitely. No, I relate so much. Thank you. Thank you for saying that. So someone else asks, how did you expose yourself to hell? So she was saying that she has done the tips that you have given already in the presentation of writing about it and thinking about it, but do you have any extra tips that you can give? Because apparently she has already tried these tips, but it hasn't been working for her so far. So if you have any extra exercises, maybe?
Yeah, and again, for this presentation, like I'm only giving educational advice. This is not medical advice. Yes. This is not mental health advice. For that, please go to a therapist or a doctor or see an ER. So, but the biggest thing is to give yourself time. A lot of times with exposure, it just takes time. Like, you know, you can expose yourself to, not to make light of it, you can expose yourself to a roller coaster, you know, 14 times in a day, and the next day still have some anxiety. Sometimes it just takes time for these things to go away. So giving yourself grace, and again, you know, reaching out to a professional if it's necessary. Like I said, I got a therapist. She's great. I like her. She's part of Secular Therapy Project. I like her a lot. And so they can be really helpful as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. There's another question, and is, okay, so the person asks, I understand why people need the concept of heaven and eternal life, but why do they have a desire for hell? Do you have an answer to that question?
So a desire for hell?
Yeah, desire for hell. So it's basically the idea that obviously it's nice to think of an ideal afterlife in which, you know, you're going to see all your family and mm-hmm. everything is going to be perfect. But why do we tend to also, you know, have this opposite of hell there? And I get in the question, it is implied that we desire that sort of hell. I'm not sure if we desire so much as it just comes with the religion. It's just like, you know, a side effect. But yeah, you can let us know.
Yeah, of course. I think that a lot of times the fear of hell kind of comes with trying to make sense of our chaotic world. You know, we look at religion, we look at rituals, and you know, ritualistic behavior is in chimps as well. For example, like they did a study where they basically made thunderstorms and made rain, and they gave the chimps tools. And whenever the chimps would use the tools, they would stop the rain. And after a while, whenever it rained, like in real life, the chimps would try to use the tools in order to make the rain to stop. Like you see these rituals develop. And I think that rituals help us to kind of make sense of the world, make sense of the chaos around us. And hell is no different. You know, if we say that, oh, if that person was a horrible person, like the person committed a lot of atrocities, that person hurt my family. And if it makes sense for us to say, okay, well, even if they didn't get their punishment here, they're going to be punished in the afterlife. I think that helps us to make sense of the world and really of our own morality as well, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it definitely does. Yeah. It's like this idea that there is like a divine justice that is going to take care of everything.
Right. Yeah. Like it's out of our hands. We have no control, which, I mean, the world is very chaotic, but I think that's just a way for us to make sense and compartmentalize that. Yeah.
Thank you. I have one here. It's about neural networks, and I'll just read it through and you let us know. Does the fear of hell hang around because neural networks fade very slowly over time, independently of rational beliefs? Once learned, then they never really go away? Question mark.
So it depends. So, for example, like I said, some individuals, we can have that switch, that flip. We no longer have the belief system, but we do create those neural pathways. So it's just like riding a bike. You know, I haven't ridden a bike in 15 years or so, but I'm sure if I got on a bike right now, I could probably still ride one. I still know the mechanics, that we have that muscle memory. We might still have those neural pathways available, but, and so our brain might still generate those automatic negative thoughts. Like, we might still have fleeting thoughts of hell, might still have fleeting thoughts of, am I a bad person? But after a while, we're no longer having the emotional attachment to it. So even though our brain is generating the thoughts, they no longer hold the power. As I said, our brain has 40,000 to 60,000 thoughts per day, and we have many thoughts that we don't even recognize. And so those neural pathways may still be existent. However, they no longer have the emotional valency attached to them.
Awesome. Thank you for that.
Yeah.
Thank you. So obviously a lot of the people who are listening to us are RFR volunteers, and they do face clients. They do deal with clients that have issues with, you know, fear of hell quite often. So do you have any tips you can give them in terms of how you can help someone else who is struggling with that in that moment, maybe distracting them, or maybe, I don't know, give them some exercises or some overall advice? Do you have any tips for our volunteers or anyone who has maybe a friend that is struggling with it?
Yeah, so I think the biggest thing is just empathize and listen. We don't, in that moment, whenever you're so I'll give a little mini biology lesson on the brain, because I love our brain. So we have this, put your fist together like this. That's about the size of your brain. I think mine should be a lot bigger. I'm just saying, a little disappointed there. So where your pinkies are right here, that is your prefrontal cortex. That's the thinking part of your brain. That is rational thought. That is your personality. That is your problem solving ability right there. If we put our thumbs in the middle here, that is your amygdala. That is your emotion part of your brain. So we're feeling anxious, we're feeling happy, we're feeling scared, we're feeling mad. The amygdala is activated. So we have to think about, in those moments, whenever people are calling and under so much distress, their amygdala is activated. They're in that emotional part of the brain. And that's important, because the thinking part and the emotion part are inversely related. The more active one is, the less active the other is. So I give these examples, like, you ever been in a fight or an argument with a spouse or a significant other, and you say something you don't mean, like 10 minutes later, you're like, why the hell did I say that? It's because we're in that emotion part of our brain, our ability to think and make rational thoughts, our filter is shut off. Or like we go to sit down and take a test in high school, and like you studied all night, you're really nervous for it, you look down at the paper and you're like, shit, I don't know any of these questions. And it takes like 2 minutes, and then all of a sudden the information comes to you. That's because your amygdala is deactivating, which means your thinking part, your prefrontal cortex, is reactivated again. And so in those moments, whenever people call, and I haven't worked the phone lines, but oftentimes what I'm expecting is that they're very emotional, they're in a very emotional state. And so they're not in a place where their prefrontal cortex may be activated. And so in that moment, we just need to, you know, talk about it, validate their feelings, talk about their feelings. And again, this isn't mental health advice, and I'm not their therapist, but whenever somebody is in an emotional state, kind of meet them where they are. Just validate the crap out of those feelings, man, because it is a very scary process.
That's great. Thank you. So we have a question about why the concept of hell is so persistent. Is it because fear sells, or is there a more conceptual way of thinking of it? In other words, do we as humans benefit from having a boogeyman?
Yes and yes and no. So I think it depends on the person. You know, in some cultures, in some religions, fear is really used as a tool for morality. In others, it's used as a way to make sense of the world. In some religions, there's no hell at all. So I think it really just depends on the individual and on the culture. There are many ways that it can be maintained, just like there's many ways that anxiety can be maintained, and many ways that, you know, sexual morality is governed in societies. Like, there's many different ways that hell is used. There's many different ways that mores are used. And so I think it just depends on the culture, to answer, not answer your question.
All right, I'll take it. Thank you.
Okay.
Makes sense. Yeah, thank you. Yeah. Do you feel like maybe, and I promise I didn't come up with this question, that people's attachment styles impact their fear of hell and damnation? Maybe the fear of abandonment from a higher power. Do you think this could be related?
That's a really good question. I'll have to think about that. So I haven't really looked into that research before. So that I would love to answer that, but I'm afraid I couldn't give a very good answer because I don't know. But I appreciate that. I'm going to write that one down too.
That's absolutely fine. I appreciate you saying, I don't know. That's better than, obviously, you know, saying something that makes no sense or something that's not based on real science and it's just like...
I can make something up. I'm a really good bullshitter. You guys still think I have a master's degree and I'm a therapist.
Wait, you don't have a master's degree? What do you mean? That is a requirement for being a speaker in our
course. I'm kidding. Absolutely you also think not. I'm a therapist, man.
Thanks for that. Haley, one more. Well, not just one more. One more from me right now. Okay. How do you determine if religious is helpful for someone, or can you?
So that's not for me to decide. No, I meet my clients where they are. In every single session, I ask, are you religious? Because if they are, then I have them explain what that means to them. I'm not just going to be like, oh, I'm Christian. Okay, Christian. Boop. Well, what does that mean for you being Christian? Are you Catholic? Are you Protestant? Are we in the deconversion process? No, because I've met somebody who's put Christian on the intake, and then I go to talk to them. They're like, well, I've been struggling with my faith for a long time, and I don't really think I believe anymore, but I still go through the motions, and so it looks different for everybody. And so for some people, it is very helpful, and some people it's not. It's not for me to decide. I'm just there to help them kind of figure out which direction they want to go. And whether they're staying with their religion or not, I'm never going to tell somebody, leave their religion, because that's not my place. For some, it's helpful. And so for some people, I have met atheists who still go to church because it's helpful for them. There's their social support network and they're cool with that. And that's cool. So it really depends on the person.
That makes perfect sense. Yeah. Thank you. So we have one last question. So if anyone wants to submit any other questions, please do so now, or I don't know, do it in the hangout session. It won't be recorded, so other people won't be able to benefit from it. So that's also fine. But, you know, anyway. The last question is from someone who thinks that fear of hell maybe comes from the fear of the unknown. So do you have any specific tips for people whose main reason why they are scared of hell is because of this connection to the fear of the unknown? Maybe like, I don't know, I can think of maybe like a reach.
Oh, I think you muted yourself, my friend. Or it's mute on my side. I'm sorry.
Sorry, am I back?
Yes, you're back.
Yeah, okay. Well, I was just starting to rumble then, so I feel like I feel like someone muted me in purpose because they could tell.
No, it's good. You're good. Absolutely good.
Yeah.
So you said you were saying that the fear of hell can come from like the fear of the unknown.
Yeah. So is there any tips that you can give for people whose main reason why they are scared of hell is because they fear the unknown? And then I feel like a follow-up of this question is something that someone also asked, which is it possible to reason your way out of fear of hell?
Okay, good questions. And so one more disclosure, not medical advice. I'm just going to speak in generals here, not medical mental health advice. But we have to remember that anxiety's goal is to think of the worst case scenario. Like, and that's really helpful to think like our ancestors. Like we hear a noise, we think it's a bear, we want to defend ourselves. Like, let's say that I'm laying in bed at night and I'm asleep, it's like 3 a.m. and I hear a crash. Now my automatic thought could be like, oh, someone's breaking into my house. And that's going to lead to fear. My brain's going to go to the worst case scenario. Let's say I'm laying in bed and I hear the crash and I think of, damn it, Steve, the cat knocked the freaking glass off the counter again. Then I'm going to have a very different response there. But what automatically happens is whenever we have any kind of unknown, typically our brain likes to fill in the gaps with anxiety. The research suggests that approximately 75 to 80% of our thoughts on a day-to-day basis are anxiety-related thoughts. And so that is because, you know, our brain is trying to protect us. Our brain is trying to make sure we're thinking of all the worst case scenarios so that way we can survive. We look at it from an evolutionary perspective. And so whenever our brain is thinking of this worst case scenario, the fear of hell, that's just another way of our brain, you know, trying to prepare us for the worst case scenario. It doesn't mean that's going to happen. You know, it's more likely that crash I heard is my cat knocking a glass off the counter than is somebody breaking into my house, more than likely, because Steve the cat is an asshole. But it doesn't mean my brain's not going to go to that worst case scenario at first. If that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes sense too. Yeah, definitely. So someone just texted me saying they want to ask the question, but they haven't asked the question yet. So I'm just going to rumble for a bit, just like a couple of minutes, and then I'll give them time to do the question. And then we can hopefully finish the Q&A. So, yeah, what you were saying about anxiety-inducing kind of thoughts and all of that, it kind of reminded me because for Halloween, I've been watching a lot of horror movies, oftentimes ghost-themed, and I don't believe in ghosts. I don't believe in demons. However, that did not stop me from believing that there was a demon in my house, you know, which I felt really stupid for thinking about that because it's like, I know that there is no evidence that that's never going to happen. I know in my heart it's just not a thing, like they just don't exist, but it is still there. And, you know, I haven't been brought up religious. So I feel like those irrational thoughts of your brain trying to protect you from, as you said, the worst case scenario is just so common. So thank you so much for sharing that, because I feel like a lot of people can definitely relate, me included.
Oh, absolutely. I'm right there with you. Like, I watched the Blair Witch Project for the first time this last weekend, or Halloween weekend, and I hid under a blanket, and like all night I was, like, heard like trees on my windows, like, freaking witch is going to get me. And like, I know that that's not the case. I know that the Blair Witch Project is fake, but you just, you feel that. And so I'm right there with you with the horror movies.
Perfect. And I love them, which is also bad for me, but I just love them so much. Like, they made me so happy and also so scared.
Do you know that? So the same chemical reaction in the brain for fear is excitement. It just depends on how we label it.
Oh, really?
That's why roller coasters are so damn exciting. Because we're terrified. We're like, oh, this is fun. So our brain is labeling it as excitement.
Yeah. Oh, that's amazing. I didn't know that.
Fun Brains fact. Are weird, man.
Definitely. Definitely.
All right. Well, while we wait, we do have another question in the chat. And it's, is there a strong correlation between persons that believe in hell and persons that need a patriarchal structure in their life?
So not necessarily. You know, when it comes to like the fire and brimstone, of course, that's more associated with the evangelist, and a lot of the evangelist religions, especially in the United States, are very patriarchal. But we do see this fear of hell happen across different cultures. And so it doesn't necessarily mean that the fear of hell is based out of the patriarchy. However, there can be some overlap because, you know, at least a lot of Western religions are very patriarchal. I mean, growing up Catholic, like, okay, I couldn't become a priest, and so had to join the Church of the Big Lebowski to get my minister's license.
That's awesome. Yeah, I can definitely relate to the growing up Catholic, like the man's word is the law. I was very thankful and lucky, but I saw it everywhere.
Yeah.
Just the man's voice was the one that was heard.
Yeah. It's very, very common. So you do see that in like the different religions. And not all of them, but fear of hell can be, there can be overlap again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Yes, so we just had another question coming through, and is, do you think that stress/anxiety was less unhealthy when more often there was a threat to be concerned about? So this idea that right now we don't have a lion chasing us down the jungle that we have to run away from. So do you feel like it was maybe healthier, like before, in, I don't know how before that would be, but if you know what I mean.
Oh yeah, so when it comes to stress and anxiety, both of them are healthy emotions, both of them are valid emotions. This becomes, whenever they become too much, they can become toxic. So even to this day, you know, we might not be running away from lions or finding snakes all the time. Like every once in a while, I find one in my garage, but that's about it. But back then, you know, there was toxic stress. I mean, if you are in constant danger and you didn't have your people to hang around with, if you didn't have shelter, you did experience that same toxic stress that we might have. We might have different triggers nowadays, we might have different pressures, but it treats the body the same. In some circumstances, they're motivating when it, like I said, comes to putting on our seatbelt, looking both ways before crossing the street, fighting off attackers in our head, Amaya, you and I. But after a while, if it becomes too much, it can become toxic. Can become hurtful. Whenever we have stress, we have those cortisol level increases, and increase in cortisol level is associated with chronic pain. It's associated with breaking apart of the cartilage in the knees. It's associated with a suppressed immune system. And so I think that more than likely back in the day, like evolutionarily speaking, there was a lot of toxic stress as well, which probably also led to a decreased life expectancy as well.
Yeah, no, that makes perfect sense. And I really do hate that has made my brain more anxious now when I don't actually need to be. But, oh well, as you said, brains are weird. So what can we do about it? Okay, so I don't see any other questions. So last 5 seconds to submit a question.
I appreciate you all and your questions. Thank you so much. And you all have given me a lot to think about today too for my own research. So I appreciate it.
Oh, please. Thank you so much for coming. I feel like it has been so, so, so amazing. Such a needed conversation too. So thank you so, so much. It's been such a pleasure for you to be here. Yeah, I can't thank you enough. And the people in the audience have been engaging so much in the comments. So thank you. Thank you guys so much too for that, because I feel like that kind of shows that the topic was really needed. So yeah, thank you, Haley. Thank you, audience. And thank you, obviously, Madeline, for co-hosting with me.
Of course, a pleasure.
Thank you guys for the opportunity. I appreciate all the work that you guys do.
Oh, thank you.
Recovering from Religion is a nonprofit organization whose mission it is to provide hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. Hope, healing, and support is waiting for you on our website, recoveringfromreligion.org. There you can speak or chat with a trained agent who will work with you through your struggles and doubts or to help find resources that may work for you. You can also find local Recovering from Religion support groups in your area for the long-term recovery work. Resources specifically curated for those struggling with doubts, disbelief, and trauma can also be found on the RFR website. To connect with a secular therapist in your area, go to seculartherapy.org and create an account. If you'd like to support the work that RFR does, you can donate or sign up as a volunteer on the Recovering from Religion website. It's also a big help subscribing to the RFR YouTube channel, our blog, or following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Questions, comments, and suggestions can be emailed to us at rfrx@recoveringfromreligion.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we hope you'll be with us next time on the Recovering from Religion podcast.